I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to the season finale of Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. By the end of 2024, a year of NATO-armed genocide, almost half the world's population will have had a chance to vote in elections meant to signal they live in democracies. Perhaps foremost for voters will be the economy. It may no longer be the largest economy by PPP, but crucial for the future of the world will be elections in the USA in November. Home to most of the world's billionaires, with over 10% of its population living in poverty, the Federal Reserve is insisting it's doing a good job. Joining me now from the crucial Electoral College state of Florida is an economist at the Heritage Foundation who makes daily economy-focused videos on YouTube and X, Professor Peter Saint-Onge. Professor, thank you so much for coming on. You said that those who questioned official US economic statistics, say, 10 years ago, were told they were crazy, but after Obama, the butcher of Libya, and Biden, And many in the U.S. don't believe U.S. Treasury figures at all on inflation, growth, jobs, and people don't think people are crazy for saying that. Why?
Yeah, things have really changed quite a bit. There was, as you say, there was a time when you were essentially crazy for doubting government statistics. No right-thinking PhD would ever be caught questioning whether these statistics were cooked. And over these past couple of years, especially during COVID, I think many of us have lost faith in these institutions. Of course, we had highly prestigious medical journals with 100-year histories publishing absolute lies, and that appears to have extended out into the economic statistics. So if we look, for example, at inflation, the official numbers in the U.S. are that we've had inflation around about 25% since the beginning of COVID. But if you look at actual prices of just about anything, they're up between 35 to 50%. Some of them are higher. Now, that matters not only because, you know, it sort of influences how voters grade Joe Biden, but it also means that all of the other statistics fall out. All right. So if you think your inflation rate is 25%, then when you subtract that from GDP growth, you might be able to say with a straight face that the economy is still growing. However, if actually the inflation rate is 35 or 50%, then it means that we're actually in a five-year recession. We may even be in a five-year depression at this point.
So if you had been advising the Labor Department there, the first one to manipulate would be the inflation figure. If you're an evil economist, not an economist who's tried to liberate the American working classes in the United States, right?
Absolutely. There are two numbers that you would most want to cook. One of them is the inflation rate. And the beauty of the inflation rate is that then you kind of get a free bonus where the growth rate also looks good. You can say, look, real GDP, once you control for inflation, is doing just great. The other number that you would want to cook is the jobs number. And they do that quite a bit. They remove people from the labor force. So, for example, sort of a common sense understanding of what unemployment is people who don't have jobs who would like to be working. But actually, they have a very restrictive definition. So you must have been actively seeking work. Okay, that means that if you're living on the street, strung out on fentanyl in San Francisco, you are not counted as unemployed. You're counted as effectively retired. All right, so we have about 5 million people who pulled out of the U.S. labor market since COVID started. So some of them went on government benefits. We had about an $800 billion durable rise in government welfare per year. A lot of those people just retired early. All right, so if you put those together, that is why the unemployment rate looks good in the U.S. Then meanwhile, you've just got all kinds of games they're playing. So part-time and full-time jobs, okay, those are both counted as jobs. Right. So the U.S. economy has actually lost, for example, 1.6 million full-time jobs over the last year. But we've gained 1.8 million part-time jobs, which could be driving for Uber. Right. It could be 3 hours a week. So if you take the minus 1.6 and the plus 1.8, magic, jobs are growing. But of course, there is a world of difference between a full-time job that can sustain a family versus driving for Uber. So really, at this point, when you see government statistics, it's almost a game where you ask, okay, what are they lying on this week? You have to break it open, look inside, and see exactly where they're cooking the numbers. Now, you might argue that that's sort of part of the game. I mean, like, you know, if one of the most important numbers that we're grading government by, okay, so let's say jobs, inflation, growth, if the government is producing the numbers, they're producing their own statistics, they're grading themselves, what could possibly go wrong? Some might argue that really what should happen is that government statistics should be completely disbelieved, right? You should treat it like Philip Morris talking about smoking and cancer. Just, yeah, of course you guys would say that. McDonald's telling you how healthy their food is. So people should have the same skepticism towards government statistics. And then there's plenty of private sector alternatives because financial markets, you know, try to figure out what's actually happening. So you have the University of Michigan survey. Every major bank tries to figure out what exactly is happening. So in my perfect world, people would just laugh government statistics out of the room.
And don't believe anything any Democrat candidate at November's election tells you about the great success.
Don't believe any politician, yeah.
Or yeah, whatever.
Absolutely.
And so, and a lot of these jobs are kind of subsidized by the U.S. government.
Yes.
I mean, how much like the USSR is the USA right now? I know where I'm from in Britain, one didn't really understand why the government was subsidizing huge profit-making corporations to give low-paid jobs to people who would also be eligible for government handouts on top of it. In effect, these big corporations in the United States are actually subsidized by the U.S. state.
Right, and this is something that it's been going on really for about 100 years now, ever since government started with central banks and income taxes. These were a massive power grab by governments. And what they fueled was this progressive takeover of the economy, where a larger and larger share of the economy is accounted for by government. Now, government, of course, is not efficient. It doesn't create wealth. It is a completely parasitic organization. And unfortunately, that organization across Europe, across Japan, across the US, it has taken half or more of all of the resources created by the public. So it's really sort of turning from a parasite into an outright predator.
Well, you could say the government's funding of education, though, has led to innovation,
sure,
which the private corporations took the money from in terms of profit, say Silicon Valley.
Oh, absolutely. Right. And anything that government touches will become crony. It will become corrupt. This is the nature of the beast. Education is one of the most destructive industries that governments have taken over, and they've really taken it over worldwide. And the model for that, sort of other countries copied, was the Prussian model. And that was the idea that government would take over education, partly in order to train the population, get them used to discipline, showing up on time, lining up when they're told, sort of create an obedient population, but also to disseminate government propaganda, right? To convince people that, you know, their government is kind and good and should be obeyed. And there was actually that system, when it was imported into the U.S., the people who brought it to the U.S., they called themselves progressives at the time. That was really the beginning of the movement. And they literally said, they were very anti-Catholic. They didn't like Catholics because Catholics have always tended to be more skeptical of governments, whereas in the U.S., there was this sort of Protestant movement that saw the government as this sort of savior of society, that government has to control everything in order to save us for ourselves. So anyway, these early progressives, really it boiled down to government versus the people. And they said, well, we can't force the Catholics to join our big government utopia, but we have their children. They literally, that was the plan. This is not conspiracy. These are, by all accounts, the people who set up the public education system in the U.S. And that has absolutely borne fruit now, right?
Yeah, COVID. So that's a few hundred years ago. But my point just earlier was, for all of that, and of course the propaganda system within education is working very well indeed, we might get onto that, there's no doubt that government, state funding for education in the sciences created pure science, which was then adopted by corporations like Texas Instruments back in the day for silicon chips and so on.
For sure.
And it was government funding for the telephone networks that then were taken by corporations that turned into internet ISPs and so on. It was the government. The only thing is today, those corporations are now being funded by, in effect, sort of tax credits and the revenue system, which allows them to be subsidized. Isn't that the point? The Facebooks of this world are subsidized by the American taxpayer, that Amazon is funded by the American taxpayer, in effect.
They absolutely are. You know, there was a story a couple of years ago. It was a woman, she's an engineer out in Silicon Valley, and she wanted to teach her kids about entrepreneurship. So she sat them down and they got out a piece of paper and she said, okay, so write out what you want your grant to be, your government grant. Okay, this is the mentality of people in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is supposed to be one of the most entrepreneurial places on earth. So a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, when they think they're going to teach their kids about entrepreneurship, the very first thing you do is apply for a government grant. That is absolutely how this works. That's how big business works in the U.S. There are entire industries that are almost entirely funded, certainly their R&D, by taxpayers. And so, you know, this is part of the reason why big business has become so friendly towards even left-wing movements in Europe and the U.S. is because they are addicted to the money. And of course, there's a separate issue that they're also threatened by government agencies. So, you know, if they don't drink the Kool-Aid on, let's say, gender ideology, then they're going to have regulatory problems. We've seen this with Elon Musk getting threatened on things. So we have a word for that, which is which begins with an F and was common in Germany in the 1930s. Unfortunately, that is really where we're headed, where large businesses have become arms of the government.
Before we get to the F, though, has that led to a decrease in the amount of innovation then in American society because of these structures? I mean, the basic innovations like the internet, like the silicon chip, we haven't seen every year on year or decade on decade, right? New innovations.
Right. Yeah, really, the golden age for the U.S. ended when the progressives took over. That was around 1910. And if you look back...
That's a bit early. That's a bit early.
Astounding. Yeah.
1910?
Well, no, for sure. But there's this sort of modern fetish that, you know, technology is moving so fast, it just makes your head spin. People have no idea what we've lost. We are moving about one-tenth the speed that we were moving before government took it over. And indeed, as you say, almost nothing was invented. Even if you take the internet, okay, so the internet is sort of held up as the poster child for government innovation. And that was actually invented in every component of the internet, all right, the wires, the computers, the digital code, every aspect of it was invented about 30 years earlier than it became popular, right? So the internet sort of took off in about the 1990s. It was all fully developed by 1950. But the U.S. government imposed limitations so that you could not commercialize it. So they actually slowed it down by absolute decades. They did not invent that. They slowed it down.
Professor Peter St. Onge, I'll stop you there. More from the Heritage Foundation economist after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Heritage Foundation economist, Professor Peter St. Onge. Professor, you were talking in part one about how the government slows down innovation. The odd thing is, of course, in a place like Cuba or Venezuela, private entrepreneurial capitalism occurs without any subsidy. You can get a license in Havana in Cuba after the 90s to do things, and there's no way the Cuban government is going to say, oh, we're going to subsidize you to pay low wages to people and so forth. Where is this coming from in the United States? You're saying just education systems, you're saying progressives. Surely those on top and those in power see this as very lucrative for them.
Oh, absolutely. It pays very, very well to partner with the government. In fact, you know, organizations like Google or Amazon spend significant amounts of time trying to come up with new ideas that they can get funded by government. We saw during the COVID censorship that they are very, very alert to the priorities of their handlers in government. They have essentially become wings of the U.S. government, which, you know, I think this is part of the reason why In the US, for example, people have been sort of traditionally relatively pro-business, certainly compared to Europe. And a lot of people now are turning against big business because they are recognizing that they have just become divisions of the government imposing whatever it is the government comes up with this week.
Now, the likely president come November, come next year after November's elections, Donald Trump has said he doesn't favor sanctions. You know, the rest of the world clearly doesn't understand why the United States would sanction itself effectively over the war in Ukraine, why it would steal sovereign funds of the Russian state if it wants the dollar's hegemonic power to continue. You have a very interesting explanation on this. Why do you think the United States would even begin to think of stealing money from Russia or other countries, freezing them, if they want the dollar to continue to be a Federal Reserve currency of the planet?
Exactly as you say. That's been the big question, is that for decades, most American commentators have assumed that the American government was moving heaven and earth to try to preserve the dominance of the dollar, whether that might be assassinating foreign heads of state who promote gold-backed currencies and so on.
And this is true. By the way, Professor, before, I know you smiled a little. This is factual and this is true that they did.
I don't doubt it. Yeah, no, I don't doubt it. That's why I bring it up. Absolutely. And so what's been interesting over these past decades now is that, especially under Biden, is that that appears to be melting away. The things they are doing, I mean, there's always a possibility they're just very stupid and they don't understand that, you know, seizing a central bank's dollars, that renders the U.S. dollar into a risky asset.
Most people give that explanation, unlike yourself.
Yeah, right. Yep. Yeah, so, it could be stupidity. The other question is that it's intentional. So it gooses the numbers domestically. If you can slash the value of the U.S. dollar, then you cut our export prices in half, right? And so then U.S. products can be much more competitive on the world market. Indeed, many countries, Japan, China, they intentionally try to weaken their currencies. Of course, the problem is that it bankrupts your people, right? Because, you know, you also raise energy prices and food prices domestically. So bankrupts your people, it robs their purchasing power. And, you know, I've advocated that a much better way to do that is simply get rid of the regulations and the taxes that are crippling American production instead of sort of going for the cheap booze and just devaluing the dollar. But that then becomes a very interesting question, because if the U.S. is no longer defending the dollar, right, if the U.S. is actually encouraging a crashing dollar so that I get some cheap headlines, then that means that there is nobody opposing the BRICS movement to try to dethrone the dollar as reserve currency. Now, at the moment, I think China is relatively distracted. Russia is obviously distracted. But in the long run, both of those countries and many others that have joined with them, I think, are very, very interested in getting this sort of imperial United States out of the business of determining fundamental infrastructure and world trade. So if the U.S. is not guarding that door, they're going to walk right through it.
Some would say they're not. Russia and China are not distracted. That's what their primary purpose is, to destroy dollar hegemonic power, beginning to trade with India, famously with rupees, and the renminbi being traded as major currencies. So, and the American people are just being kept in the dark about all of this. And what does it mean for bond prices then? What do you advise foreign leaders who may be watching this program, who own a U.S. government debt, if the dollar is no longer the hegemonic currency? How slowly must they unwind their positions before a global crash?
That's always the question. If you are a country dealing with large numbers, and if you start moving, if you start selling things, then that could hit the price pretty hard. Of course, on the other hand, China sold off about a third of its treasuries in the past 5 years, and that apparently
U.S. treasuries
market all that much. Yeah. So it's, you know, if you're in Indonesia or in Egypt or something, then I think it does make sense to diversify out of the dollar. Really, no other country on earth imposes sanctions the way that the U.S. does. And, you know, it's one thing to go after Russia for invading its neighbors. Most countries don't do that. But they've actually been expanding that. So just last year, the Biden administration was threatening Uganda because they had a law outlawing homosexual activity. So that is the kind of law that I can imagine many countries in the world. Most countries in the world are not at all woke, as you know. They're not interested in the these sort of activist agendas that are popular in the U.S. and Europe. So that's the kind of law that I can very much see African countries implementing. If the bar has been lowered to that point for U.S. sanctions, then I think it becomes imperative for countries to diversify, whether it's into gold, whether it's into real assets, things like ports and mines, oil fields, or whether it's just into other currencies.
Yeah, it's what Dubai is doing. And so it's nothing to do with human rights, actually. It could be the implication there that this is about a cheap way in the minds of, it's not a cheap way in the long term, clearly, but in the minds of these policymakers in the Treasury to show balance sheet surpluses for free or something. You've also been talking about oil prices. It's very odd in an election year, by the way, to be doing this because, as you say, foreign imports will be more expensive and so forth. Biden and Blinken, they flew to Saudi Arabia to beg the GCC and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to increase production, as you'd expect a U.S. president to do in an election year. They were denied that. What role is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve this election in November? What role is it going to play?
Yeah, apparently it is being used as a political football at this point. So for anybody in the audience, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, in theory, it's this large stockpile of oil in the U.S. They put it in disused caves. And the idea is that if we run into some kind of geopolitical trouble, then you still have enough oil domestically to run the ambulances and so on. And that had been sort of a sacred cow. Every president, it was sort of considered outside of politics, right? This is a national security issue. You don't mess around with it. Biden has done exactly that. So he drained it before the last election in 2022. He drained it pretty substantially, I think roughly about half. And it was a large drain. And that's the question at this point, is whether they're going to drain it again for the incoming election. I can't imagine, given how little integrity there is in this administration, I would have to assume that they're going to drain every last drop to try to get oil prices down in time for the election. Now, of course, once you've drained out the SPR, you've got nothing left. You've got no buffer left except for sort of ongoing domestic production. So that would leave America very exposed, but it would definitely be on brand for this president to sell security down the river in order to get some temporary benefit.
Now, we don't get that kind of information on the business television channels. Even on TikTok, some of your videos, I understand, are not on TikTok, this social media site controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, according to some people in Congress. Why is the media like CNN, like CNBC, like Bloomberg, like all of these Fox Business, why are they? I mean, Fox Business occasionally allows some other voices. I think you've been on it.
I
Why
have.
are they not allowing this kind of information to be given to the American voter before November?
Yeah, Fox Business has been a lot better than most of them. You do have sort of Republican-aligned media that is talking about a lot of these things, partly because they don't like the administration, and so they're happy to report any sort of bad news. I think what's more concerning is the mainstream media in the U.S., which is left-leaning, it's Democrat-aligned. So this is Bloomberg, Reuters, New York Times, outfits like these, CNN. And they have just really sort of thrown their journalistic integrity away, right? They were always sort of left-leaning, but that was hidden for a long time. And really, it started probably around Obama. We can speculate as to why it started right around that time, them sort of just throwing off the mask and going full on to try to support the official narrative. But we've seen this in Europe as well, I think, where the media traditionally had some pretense of objectivity. They've thrown that away. I would guess it's probably social media that did it, where they realized that their audience was melting away and they had to have stronger points of view. But however we got here at this point, the world is really in this epidemic of censorship. Granted, it's a lot better since Elon bought Twitter or X, but we are still very much sort of in the trenches fighting for our ability to speak. And as you say, my videos have been strangled on YouTube, I believe. It's always possible they were crap videos, but When I address certain topics, my readership drops by 2/3 or 3/4, which you're in media, you know, that's not normal. And on TikTok, my videos actually get banned consistently. So I had one on the Trump assassination that was taken down within 10 minutes for a community violation. Of course, I talk about the economics of it. I don't talk about anything gory, but there it went. And actually,
I got to interrupt there. Sorry, because we're coming to a close here. Yeah, I got banned for TikTok about a Trump assassination thing, and it was nothing to do with conspiracy theories, as they're called. Who knows what it is? And I, left or right, I'm not sure whether left is the right word to describe these financial channels. The left-right debate, I'm not sure. I don't know, state? The state? Who knows? Just finally, for anyone watching, I got to ask, you're in favor of gold, which is, tends to be a standard one for people. I mean, how, what's to stop them manipulating gold prices like they did hundreds of years ago when kings used to manipulate it? You're for gold, you're for crypto. These are good things going forward in a world where they're lying about all their statistics, all their figures, all their profit ratios.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can always manipulate prices. You know, this is very common on Wall Street. They'll try to push a price up on one day and down on another. And this might be because there's an option expiration or whatever. You can try to do that. But the thing is that it'll cost you a lot of money, right? So if the true price of something is 100 and you're consistently trying to keep it at 80, 80, 80, you're going to lose money constantly doing that, right? That is in stark contrast to what happens with, say, paper money, where, well, the true price of the dollar is actually collapsing. You know, they can just print it at will. So you're always going to have a lot more solidity with something like gold or Bitcoin, for that matter. I'm actually a fan of Bitcoin because it can't be seized, right? This, I think, is the fundamental flaw of gold. I love gold. I would name my children after gold if I could do it over again. But the problem is that when you have a gold-backed currency, you have to tell people where the gold is, right? You can't just tell people, I got gold, but it's a secret where it is. You got to show them where it is. Once you show them where it is, government also knows where it is. Historically, governments always will capture the money. They'll go show up, visit your gold storage, and they'll tell you what they think they should do. You should do with it. So, you know, as I think hard money is really the question. A hard money, I think, is critically important to economic growth, to innovation, to people sort of having the correct horizons, the correct timelines to make decisions in life. They become more responsible, more prudent. But having said, whether it's gold or Bitcoin, I think that it's very important we get there, and I think we will.
Professor Peter St. Orange, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for the show and this season. We'll be back on the last day in August. Until then, we'll be bringing you some of your favorite episodes. You can still keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you very soon.